Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Gigabit Nation, Broadband Talk Radio. I'm your host, Craig Settles, and I want to thank everyone in the audience for taking time to be with us today. Our mission, as always, is to provide information to help public, private, and nonprofit organizations get faster, better broadband everywhere it needs to be. When it comes to broadband, one of the pivotal federal agencies to influence its deployment and adoption is the Federal Communications Commission. They play a major role in influencing policy and also have several funds that provide monetary support for deployment and adoption. One of the biggest champions in the FCC of consumer and community interest has been Commissioner Mignon Clyburn. And she will continue to be a champion, having recently been confirmed by the Senate to begin her second term as commissioner. A couple of weeks ago, we had former Bureau Chief Sharon Gillette on the show to talk about a lot of the daily work that goes on within the FCC. Today, I'm delighted to have Commissioner Clyburn on to provide some big picture perspective on a couple of major issues that impact a lot of people throughout the country. Commissioner Clyburn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Craig. It is my pleasure to join you.
And it is a pleasure having you back again. Now, I know that you're pretty busy these days, so let's jump right in here. In 2011, when you were first on the show, we discussed lifeline reform. And let's recap and move forward. What was the main objective of that particular reform action, and where is the FCC in this process a year and some months later?
Well, again, thank you for allowing me to come to shed a little bit of light on these vital and critical programs that Congress has established and the FCC is implementing. So one of the things, if someone were to really critically look at their phone bills, they will see a line that says universal service. And a lot of people wonder what that is. But the Universal Service Fund in total is a program that is designed to ensure that there's affordable phone service for all. A lot of individuals are not so fortunate like you and me, though you're a little richer than I am.
Yeah.
There are a lot of persons who qualify as low income. And so this program attempts to bridge the communications gap in a whole host of ways. Number one, you mentioned Lifeline. That is a part of the Universal Service Fund. The other is E-Rate, which is connecting schools and libraries in areas across the nation. And there's a rural healthcare component to the Universal Service Fund that ensures that those facilities that are helping those in need have the information infrastructure to ensure service. So the Lifeline program, the reason why we thought it was so important to reform the Universal Service and to reform the Lifeline program is that we needed to ensure that it was on a sustainable path. The overall program was growing. It's well over $8 billion. And there were a lot of people critical of that figure, and it's become increasingly a larger part of our telephone bill experience. So what we did was look at the program and said, how can it become more efficient and more in line with our modern communications needs? So we set out to extract efficiencies, and one of the things we did was to, again, ensure that there are not a lot of duplicates, to ensure that the critical needs, communications needs, are being met through these programs, including Lifeline.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just interrupt for a quick second. I saw in the press release that in one of the areas that you were looking for efficiencies, you found about $14 million in cost savings and whatnot. Probably good to talk about that a little bit, because that's a fairly decent chunk of change there, actually.
Well, we had, in terms of the Lifeline program, we had a $200 million saving target that we are seeking, to realize, and we are in line to do that. And so one of the things was to ensure that the providers of service are doing so in a manner that is consistent, again, with good business, good governance, and good engagement. So we got rid of a lot of the duplicates that were happening because a lot of people did not know that they might have had a landline and a mobile phone experience, but they were getting basically two or more extractions, I guess you would say, from the Lifeline program. They were getting subsidized more than once. So one of the things that we did was realize, those efficiencies, ensure that the providers were in compliance. There were some providers that they made the news that they were not acting in good faith. So we did some things to ensure that. But these types of reforms are helping to sustain the overall program, and these reforms are so targeted to ensure that the communications landscape is available and open for all. Lifeline is truly a lifeline, connecting people to jobs, to healthcare, and the like. And so to ensure that it's sustainable, to ensure it's remains affordable in terms of communications delivery. It was our, those are our number one goals.
Mm-hmm. And one of the real issues, too, with the reform is that one of the changes coming to Lifeline was to make it so that it would support broadband as well as traditional phone service. And I'm gathering from looking over the number of pilot projects that were announced recently that you followed through with that realm. In other words, these pilot projects are looking at delivering the same affordability but providing the lifeline to broadband as well as telecom services.
It is recognizing that the steps that we're taking is in recognition of the fact that the way we communicate now is different from when the program was established.
Right.
It was once a voice-only experience. Now it's voice, it's data, it's video. And so we need to recognize and ensure that all of the public connected accordingly. Because 80% of the Fortune 500 companies today only take online applications. So if you do not have that engagement, if you don't have that connectivity from a broadband perspective, either in the home or in our schools and libraries, then how are the citizens, how will they be able to take advantage of these services? How will they be able to apply for a job? If you go to Walmart, Target, or the like, you have to go online to fill out that application. You do not walk into these stores, no matter what the level of remittance is in terms of your salaries, you do not walk into these jobs or these places of business and fill out an application. So we recognize all of that this program is seeking to bridge the gap, but is now going to bridge the gap in a modern way in terms of how we are communicating. We recognize that. And one of the things you mentioned, a pilot project. In December, we announced 14 pilot projects in 21 states, and the primary goal of these projects is for us to obtain useful information in order to better provide service delivery in as it relates to a modern broadband-enabled engagement. So these pilots will cover 21 states, Puerto Rico, as well as one tribal nation, in order to provide the information we need. But the incredible positive byproduct is that almost 75,000 low-income consumers who now lack broadband will then, at the end of the project, will have subsidized service. So it is a win-win, meaning we will get the information we need to know how we should go forward with the delivery of services, Lifeline services, to our citizens. But 75,000 people will, within 18 months, be connected that did not have the infrastructure or the means by way of affordability to do so.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I picked up on looking through that list of projects is that there are a number of local telecommunication companies, a number of local telecom co-ops, which I take to be a good sign that the pool of providers that are going to be engaged with this program in the long run will include a fair number of smaller players.
It absolutely had to, because mm-hmm. when we look at where those disconnects are in terms of broadband engagement, both from an infrastructure standpoint, and we can talk about that a little later, as well as an adoption standpoint, they are in these what we sometimes refer to as donut holes in this nation. And so we knew we had to have a targeted approach where things are harder. Where the expense mechanism is more difficult, where the business case cannot often be made. And mm-hmm. so we're going into those areas with a targeted engagement, recognizing if we are to literally connect America in terms of having a modern-day communications experience, we've got to figure out how to most efficiently tackle those areas where the business case just simply is not made, cannot be made, and the investment is not following because that business case has not been made.
Now, let's shift direction for a little bit. We'll come back to the infrastructure question. But I think one of the bigger attention-grabbing reforms that's going on right now is the Connect America Fund. And yes. I think a lot of our listeners have been keeping tabs on that. I mean, it started with a small piece of the big USF fund. I mean, the USF fund itself was pretty much in the billions of dollars. But
over $8 billion, right.
Right. And it started with a phase one $300 million funding program, if you will, that got a fair amount of participants, but then also a number of people decided not to participate. What's this phase two that's starting to unfold?
Well, to reemphasize that the Universal Service Fund is made up of has four components, one of which you mentioned, which is the high cost program, which seeks to do just what it, what you put forth to bridge that gap. To address the critical needs in areas where the business case could not be would not be made and service would not be delivered, but for a more enhanced engagement. So each and every one of us again pays into that program. So going forward, as a part of the reforms, we now call this the Connect America Fund. And you're right; it has been broken down into two phases. The first phase, there was an infusion, of $300 million. You alluded to the fact that not all of that money was taken, accepted, but $300 million was made available last year to areas where there is currently not service being provided. What we found and what we saw is 80% of those unserved consumers live in an area served by what we call price cap carriers, meaning those carriers, it's just like it sounds, that they have a particular price in which they charge consumers, as opposed to a rate of return carriers, which they are guaranteed, just what I said, a certain percentage of rate of returns. So there will be price fluctuations. But in this particular case, we recognize that most of the unserved, 80%, were in these areas. So we, in terms of Connect America Phase 1, provided up to $300 million for those areas. And at a certain cap per area, $775 per location that we would provide for companies to provision service in areas where it does not exist. They have up to 5 years to meet these obligations. They have reporting requirements and the like. And the reason why we thought this was so important, that we knew this was so important in terms of providing service as well as, you know, to ensuring the outcomes that we wanted, is that we know, like we were saying earlier, that if we don't address the critical communications needs of the American consumers, that there will be further and further and more disparities. That is unacceptable for this administration. So we have this targeted approach to ensure that this particular framework for fixed line experience is made more robust and more modern. But mm-hmm. one of the things that made history as it relates to this also was that for the first time, the commission found that the mobility engagement, your mobile engagement, should be supported also. I don't have to tell you that in terms of lower income areas and African American and Latino areas, that mobile device, that cell phone, literally is the lifeline. And so what we said was that there needs to be a two-prong engagement from a fixed standpoint as well as from a mobile standpoint, and we also offered up to $300 million in one-time support to provide advanced mobile voice and broadband services where 3G or better service was not existing. So we mm-hmm. had 33 winning bidders in that category. Most of the money was taken advantage of, and pretty soon, 83,000 road miles in 31 states and one territory will have a more robust mobile broadband and mobile voice experience, strengthening our public safety and communications landscape all over the nation.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to ask a question which is going to require a little bit of speculation, probably. A number of providers, of smaller providers, took some amount of money, but didn't take all that they were eligible for a number of reasons. And I think a number of folks, you know, outside of the process have wondered, you know, would it come down to, you know, a number of the larger providers deciding not to take the money? What do you expect is going to be the impact if you don't have providers, or at least what I would call the traditional providers, accepting this money to meet the needs in these unserved communities? Are you going to reach out and be more aggressive at getting non-traditional providers, smaller providers, community networks? I mean, it looks like, and this is just a small tip of the iceberg, $300 million. I mean, we still have the bigger.
And that's in phase one. And then phase two, there'll be more, right, engagement, right.
But how do you foresee getting past the fact that a number of providers don't see a value in participating in the program?
Well, one of the things we did in order to ensure that we had the most robust and most efficient and quick engagement, because this is about doing things as close to now as possible. So what we decided to do in phase one of both experiences was to, particularly on the landline experience, was to direct support at those carriers that already had a presence, and that this is a key, that had the eligible telecommunications, carrier status that is necessary to qualify for these funds. So I mentioned on phase one of the Connect America, on the landline fixed experience, that not all of the money was taken advantage of. So what we're doing is reevaluating looking at different proposals to see what our next steps should be so that we can get that money and get this robust experience that we are looking for, ensuring that that helps in terms of the communications landscape. But that in and of itself answers your question that could provide opportunities for smaller and other regional players who have the necessary status needed. So I am hopeful that, you know, providers that were not the incumbent carriers, when they see those opportunities, ideally will comment, will engage, and let the FCC know just how much they could enhance the communications experience in this manner. And I am incredibly hopeful that we will have a robust number of players, small and large, incumbent and not, and competitive, to take advantage of these opportunities and provide service for the American public that is currently not enabled with modern day networks.
So then it sounds like from that you're saying that one of the tactics you're looking at is maybe making it easier for smaller providers and maybe even community networks to qualify for ETC, because that's kind of the linchpin for which providers are eligible not only for the phase two money but also for the bigger pie.
Well, and when you qualify, you know, to be an eligible telecommunications carrier, that happens in one of two ways. In the bulk of the nation, it happens at the state level with the PUCs, the Public Utility Commissions, or the Public Service Commission is what it's called in my home state. You have to, you know, qualify, make application, and qualify as an eligible carrier at that level. There are a handful of states that, you know, come to the FCC for that engagement. So we have to take care of, you know, that part of the eligibility experience before we can engage from this standpoint. But one of the great things about the FCC is that we have several notices along the way, notices of proposed rulemaking in this case, in which any party can engage. And if by chance the thresholds are too high or the hurdles, you know, are too significant, there is an opportunity for persons, you know, to file comments for our consideration, and we will address those at the time. You know, we come up, you know, with rules and regulations, and we come up and put forth reforms in order to ensure that we are good stewards of the public's money, because it's your money coming out of out of your pockets each month when you pay your bill. Mm-hmm. And just as important, we want to ensure that widely available, universal service from a provisioning standpoint is made available, and it is made available in an affordable manner. So it's how we get there. Oftentimes we have to worry about in terms of the detail, but it's important for all of those eligible and wanting to be eligible. Let us know if by chance there are some disconnects that are preventing an ideal experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you don't get into a lot of the, you know, the mechanics of a lot of the day-to-day stuff because there's just so many different things going on. But do you see an increase of a role for the wireless ISPs? I think of once you get past the co-ops, you know, and some of them are a little disgruntled and feel like, you know, they're not getting into the system well enough. WISP tend to be very vocal about, you know, the participation. Would changes to, not changes, but making the ETC process easier, should that bring in more of the WISP community?
Well, when you say easier, I want to ensure, you know, to let everyone know that these are critical services that we're speaking about. Mm-hmm. So if, again, the application process is too onerous and the like, yes, I would definitely be an advocate for making that part of it easy. But I am not going to make any excuses about having an engaged, extremely critical evaluation process. Because, again,
right.
We're talking about critical services. There are very few things more critical than the ability to communicate in terms of public safety obligations and again being in touch with your loved ones and the like. So the critical evaluation process, again, that's got to remain. If
right.
there are things in terms of our matrix that are keeping out good players, then I am all for ensuring that that we do everything we can, to lower that bar if it's getting in the way.
Mm-hmm. And I'm a pretty big advocate of the accountability factor and making sure that the people, the companies, the entities that are applying for funds are qualified to do the work and get the job done as they were, awarded these projects to do.
And again, we're talking about the public's money. Each mm-hmm. month you pay into the fund, so it's not discretionary to us.
Right,
we really
exactly.
have to, we really have to ensure that, again, we're good stewards.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and I, the last time you were on the show, talked a little bit about the idea of making funds available. Well, I mean, I brought up the idea making funds available to communities based on eligibility. Say, for example, there are 1,000 people in a community that are eligible for Lifeline, or
mm-hmm.
there are, 2,000 people in an area that's, unserved or underserved, that a certain amount of money can be made available from these funds, the Connect America funds, but let the community find and justify the solution for that particular community. So in other words, they might say, well, we have $100,000, or sort of similar, I guess, to the E-rate program. We
mm-hmm.
have a block of money. We want to achieve X, Y, and Z as far as getting adoption and infrastructure built out and so forth. And, we're going to open up the bid. People come in. We pick the ones that we want, and we hold them accountable, and we report back. I mean, that was kind of the scenario that I laid out. Is this a viable scenario? Can we one day maybe have something like that in place that still meets congressional mandate as well as, the logistical considerations?
Well, I think just listening and getting refreshed on our conversation, that the pilot projects are sort of reflective of some of that.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the robust. There's no one size fits all type of. When you look at the diversity of the 14 carriers that were awarded, it is a communications cornucopia, so to speak, and I think that's a positive. For what you're speaking of, one of the other things that we're engaged in is the Connect to Compete program, which is looking at all aspects of the adoption and communications experience, particularly as it relates to broadband. So what is happening in that engagement with different providers, with private engagements, with Best Buy, with a whole host of individuals, because it really does take a village to handle this, is we're seeing people from public libraries, from community interest groups, and the like, being a part of the solution. So in terms of, how they're remunerated or what type of economic engagement, I am hopeful that with an ongoing dialogue and exchanges, we can work out some of those particulars. But the Connect to Compete program recognizes that Mignon Clyburn coming into your neighborhood and assisting you, number one, if it's from a technical standpoint, we both will be in a lot of trouble. But you would be more comfortable, I suspect, with people in the communities in which you are you call home, helping you with the experience. So what I'm hoping is, some composites of what you're putting forth, But a lot of that is recognized in the experiences in some of the partnerships that are being realized. And we need to do a better job possibly of getting the word out, particularly. So, have your readers and your listeners, everything is a reading for me, but have your listeners check out Connect to Compete and what the goals and objectives are, and really engage, really give feedback, because we don't have all of the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, how best to deliver services, and how best for us to go forward. You know, all of those things are important, and it can only happen with a mutual engagement.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. One of the we're going to shift gears a little bit for our last 10 minutes. One issue that seems to be coming up with greater frequency is the issue of competition. And mm-hmm. There is a feeling, particularly among our, you know, a lot of our advocates, that the competitive state of broadband is lacking in the U.S. That, and in fact, I'm engaged in a needs assessment project for a community in Iowa where there are providers technically there, but they're not providing the kind of services that people need. And the most common, like when we did a survey, the most common response, and these are from everyday folks, was that we don't have enough competition. We don't have enough options. We don't have good prices because we don't have enough good options. How do you see the state of competition in the U.S.? And I know that you guys are bound by certain regulations and requirements mm-hmm. and so forth, but how do you see competition, and how does the FCC maybe influence greater competition?
Well, one of those I think about that. This is when it's difficult for me to just keep my FCC hat on and not put on my Mignon Clyburn hat. So let me go ahead and fuse, give you a hybrid, approach to all of this. So when I hear you say that, I'm not in disagreement. I look at certain pockets, especially in those areas where there's a lack of concentration by way of population, or there might be some income issues and the like, and certain assumptions made about how robust the engagement would be from an adoption standpoint, or how lucrative returns would be for a particular company. In those areas, there has a tendency to be a little, competition. There are a lot of big national players that, if you were to look at their portfolio, it's pretty healthy and I'll just leave it at that. But there are a number of ways that I believe we can address this. Again, through these projects, I'm hoping that we will be able to gain a lot of insights. If we are, in terms of our evaluations, both at the federal and state levels, if we're not doing enough, and there are good ideas that are percolating in the outside of these walls, it's incumbent upon all of your listeners to challenge all of us. And that challenge to me comes in part two. I mentioned the state experience not by accident, because it is minimally a dual track. I think you and I may have talked about some of the laws that have been passed at the state level, including my home state and neighboring state, that would make it extremely difficult for some of the local governments to provision services that might provide some of the competitive options and opportunities you put forth. And so there have been some legislative addressing of these issues that I think would negatively impact some of the outcomes that that the public might want. So it has to be a multi-tiered engagement. It has to be, you, Craig, challenging the FCC, but you, Craig, also challenging the state legislators and challenging the PUCs or the PSCs in terms of what we could and should be doing to provide those competitive options, which we all want, because competition is good, And to provide those competitive options will provide enhanced and more robust and specialized services for all. I might not need as many, bites or, as much, engagement as someone else. And the price points and the options, if we have a competitive, robust environment, could reflect that. But it's not going to happen naturally without agitation, so to speak, from all of those who care about, these a more robust experience. So I encourage all of you at multiple levels to be vocal, to submit options, to file in dockets, to do whatever you can to communicate your desires, and you've got a commissioner here who would listen to all credible options brought forth.
Mm-hmm. And to wrap us up today, during the height of the broadband stimulus craziness is probably the best word to describe all that went on.
Your words, not mine.
All right, so my words definitely. But you went around to a lot of communities and held forums, held community meetings, and so forth. Will you continue to do that in these upcoming months and years?
As much as I can, and the reason why I say that is you probably are, I know you're engaged with some of the things that are happening on Capitol Hill, which affect our budgets. Mm-hmm. So I am sort of on a budgetary leash, so to speak, I'm able to make some of the, some of the engagements as many as I would like. Mm-hmm. But what we try to do is leverage as best we can trips and opportunities, and I would be glad to let you know when I am traveling, if we could leverage those types of experiences, I would be definitely open to do that. But the answer is yes, but I will have to say that there are some budgetary challenges that are not under my control that will dictate or govern that.
Mm-hmm. So in wrap-up, final question, what's the one thing that individuals and communities can do to get their side of the story in and help influence policy when they don't have the same kind of, inside the beltway access that a lot of the big companies do? And I know there's probably
I would say leverage. There are a lot of other organizations that have similar goals and objectives as you. Align up with them. There are a lot of local and regional grassroots organizations and public interest groups that are looking for causes. Challenge them, present them, increase your individual, ecosystem in terms of engagement. It really, we're in a season where we're, this is King Week, for those of us who are celebrating and honoring the man. And I always think about him as a single individual man who, after all of this time, was still discovering and speaking about his experiences and his accomplishments and how that is still, lighting sparks in all of us. He did this before Twitter, before Facebook, before an internet connection. Just imagine, with these connected communities, with these modern tools that we have at our disposals, whether or not they're in our homes or in our libraries or wherever, we have them at our disposal. Just think about what we can do to influence and connect. We should not ever see the power in which we have. Especially with this modern engagement, especially with people all over the world that share our experiences. Speak your voice, disseminate that information, align yourself with like-minded individuals, and help us provide and provision better policies to help this nation.
And that's a pretty fitting conclusion to this discussion. I definitely see your point. We have the ability within our grasp if we make the effort and we use the tools that we have, because the tools we have now are obviously much greater than they were
50 years ago. Absolutely.
So, excellent. I know you have to run, so I want to thank you for taking time to be my guest. I'm always honored to have you on the show. Much continued success, and I'll be keeping track and letting folks know what's going on, you know, from your office and within the FCC as much as possible. So,
Greg, thank you so much for your support, but thank you more so for your challenges.
Sure, not a problem. You have a great day and a great week.
And you the same.
All righty. And thank you very much to our audience for participating. I want to thank you for being here. You know, I do this show to try to, bring a lot of voices into the mix that need to both educate us and inspire us and move us forward in this broadband effort. Tomorrow is going to be a rather, I think, significant show. Last week, the FCC Chairman Jenikowski announced a challenge, if you will, a challenge to bring gigabit cities to every state in the U.S. And this announcement has been met with an interesting mix of, applause and skepticism, and a number of folks asking, so how do we actually get to that goal? Is the goal enough of a goal? Are we challenging ourselves enough to, by having a goal of, one gigabit city per state? Tomorrow I'm bringing together five folks from within the broadband, the community broadband arena to talk about the challenge, to talk about the FCC's position, and really to talk about what it will take to get more of these networks in place, what kind of challenges there are going to be, what kinds of expenses there might be. We have a very interesting collection of folks who represent the media. We have Jim Baller coming in to talk about some of the policy and legal issues. We have Chris Mitchell coming on to talk about, the state of, where we are with communities bringing gigabit networks online. What are some of their challenges? We have representation from the private sector through the CEO of Hiawatha Broadband, who will talk about public-private partnerships. And the purpose of this show is to have 90 minutes of, a number of perspectives really talking about what does it mean, once we get past the announcements, past the press releases and so forth, when we've got to face the heavy lifting of getting broadband into place, when we have to face the heavy lifting of addressing policy issues and so forth. So I encourage everyone to get engaged, to show up tomorrow, to listen, to educate, call in with your own comments, because as great a representation as we'll have with the five people tomorrow, we can never have enough. We can never have enough voices. So with that, I am going to sign off. And again, thanks everyone for being here. Hope to see you tomorrow and in all of our future shows as we continue to address the issue of getting broadband everywhere it needs to be. Thank you and have a wonderful day.